I'm Alexis Dion.
And I'm Chelsea.
And we're the co-hosts of High Priority, a podcast where we ask industry experts the tough questions about the past, present, and future of the cannabis industry.
So, Alexis, how are we doing this beautiful fall day?
You know, I'm just kind of sad that summer is over. I feel like I've had the best summer ever. I've smoked some of the best weed this summer. Shout out to Select for their incredible concentrates. My eyes have just been opened. It's just been a weedful summer. How about you?
I love that. My summer was pretty busy. I did not have the hot girl summer I wanted, but I am going to embrace hot girl fall. I'm going to go all out at MJ BizCon. I'm going to
Back up now. You can't say MJ BizCon and not explain what that is.
It is the biggest industry event in Vegas. It's happening in a few weeks in October. I don't know how I feel about going to Vegas right now, but it's open for business and I am mentally preparing myself to get sick.
No,
it's not going to happen. I've been to like some weddings and like indoor events where I was like convinced I was going to get sick and I didn't. So that bodes well.
Okay. See, positive thinking. I'm actually really excited too, because this is going to be my first MJ BizCon. You clearly have been to it before. Yes. So what should I look forward to? Because I've heard that like people are just, you know, partying day and night. There's, you know, weed everywhere.
It might be just a little different this year because like you have to wear a mask the whole time because of like Vegas has a mandate. Like if you're not checking your vaccination, I think everyone has to wear a mask. So like, I don't know, does that apply to the club? I have no idea what to expect. But in previous year, I mean, I've only gone once. I went in 2019, but no, it was a lot of drinking, lots of networking.
Naturally.
Yeah. Definitely stay hydrated, stretch, eat a good meal before a networking event, you know, just socializing 101. These are things we all learned in college, make good decisions. It'll be good to meet some of our clients in real life, some Natio team members in real life, maybe even some high priority guests in real life. Who knows, right?
Yes. Oh my gosh. I would be so excited to meet new people to bring on the podcast. I mean, so far we've interviewed some amazing people and it's just been good just learning about them and how they've been navigating the industry. And obviously most of our guests have been people of color. So love hearing their stories.
Absolutely. And speaking of exceptional guests and great minds in the industry, we are talking to Tahir Johnson today. He is the Director of Social Equity and Inclusion at the U.S. Cannabis Council and the Marijuana Policy Project. And as if he wasn't busy enough, he also hosts the Cannabis Diversity Report, which is his own podcast. Yeah. And he's also interviewing entrepreneurs of color, up and coming, you know, business owners. And, you know, I'm just really excited to pick his brain. We first were introduced to him and we as a Natio was first introduced to him when we were planning South by Southwest panels for the 2020 event, we were planning in 2020 for the 2021 event. But he is just like this fountain of wisdom. He started in finance and then worked at a dispensary and then, you know, realized that, you know, there just aren't enough opportunities, not enough access and inroads for people of color to enter the industry, and has really like dedicated his life to creating tangible, meaningful opportunities at both like a national and local level. So he has so much wisdom and he's like helped, you know, small businesses apply for licenses. He's applied for licenses himself. So he just like knows so much and I'm excited to, just learn and listen to him speak and educate us.
You know what? I think it's going to be really great for us to hear how people of color can get into the industry without having to work directly with cannabis, without directly having to touch the plant, right? Because a lot of people are still kind of skeptical or they just don't want to go through all the hoops that there are in place for people who are plant touching and plant facing. So I would be interested to hear his perspective on how people of color can get into the ancillary space of cannabis.
Yeah, absolutely. I know he's definitely spoken at length in the past about it, and he's really passionate about just getting anyone interested, you know, through any entrance. So I hope our listeners can also learn some important things from this conversation as well. So let's jump right in. Welcome to Here. You are one of the driving forces behind social equity within the cannabis industry today. And fortunately, the Matteo team first connected with you when we were building out our South by Southwest social equity panel last year, which you were selected for and spoke on, which is awesome. It's such a privilege to have you on our show today. For our handful of listeners who may not be as familiar with your background, can you give us a brief overview of how and why you left your career in finance to basically run social equity initiatives at the industry's top trade organizations?
Sure, absolutely. First, I'll say it's definitely a pleasure to be a guest on a podcast. I'm so happy to get to, talk to you guys. And man, it was so dope doing South by Southwest last year. Definitely hope we get selected for our panel here. So I'll be looking forward to that.
Fingers crossed.
Yes, fingers crossed for sure. But like you said, I've definitely had a had an exciting career in the cannabis industry, even new developments since last year now. Have the opportunity to lead social equity and inclusion at both the U.S. Cannabis Council and the Marijuana Policy Project. I started out in finance. I was actually an investment advisor prior to getting into cannabis. And I started the transition in 2018, made the full transition to cannabis in 2019. One of the reasons that I made the change was because when I was in finance, one of my largest focuses was financial literacy for communities of color. You know, I always found that, you know, that minorities, we had less access to financial professionals and the financial literacy that we needed to be able to get ahead, causing the wealth gap, right?
Right.
You know, African-Americans have 1/10 the wealth of our white counterparts. So when you look at the cannabis industry, as I started to learn more and more about it, I saw this as a great opportunity for one, because of the history of cannabis, where we've had our, even today, the ACLU report shows that African-Americans are almost 4 times more likely to be arrested for cannabis. And here we are, we have this multi-billion dollar industry that's expected to do $24 billion in sales this year. And people of color, African-Americans, are largely absent from ownership. So, you know, as somebody from finance and looking at the generational wealth opportunity and just hearing about the way that was expected to happen, you know, it's something that attracted me to the industry to want to be able to make a difference, you know, especially in that area, due to the fact that access to capital is, you know, one of the biggest barriers for, you know, minority entrepreneurs. I wanted to take everything that I had learned and done in finance to be able to make an impact here.
And you have definitely made that impact so far.
I'm always trying to continue doing the work, you know, and in finance, it was very similar, even as, you know, in terms of like people that were licensed financial advisors, there were very few numbers of people of color and very few women in that industry. And so, you know, having the opportunity to work on diversity, equity, and inclusion in finance was always, like, again, one of the big things that was an influence that I brought with me to cannabis.
Right, right. And you've also applied for licenses yourself, is that right?
I have, yeah. When I started out in the industry, one of the first things that I did in 2019 with my team, Community Wellness, we applied for cultivation and processing licenses here in Maryland, and also apply for the vertically integrated licenses in New Jersey. So I've got to see firsthand, man, like all the different things that go into it, from, you know, having to build relationships with municipalities where you want to do business, to hiring different contractors and, you know, building a diverse team, and, you know, the difficulty of the amount of money that it takes and the amount of expertise. So again, having that firsthand experience of having to go through it is always something that I bring to the table when I look at what minority entrepreneurs have to go through in the industry, especially the differences that access to relationships and so many other things can make a difference in. And, you know, that's one of the things that I've seen. And since I've had the opportunity to be, you know, in the different groups that I am, to try to always expand access to opportunity, because I know the difference that can make in people's journey.
That's perfect, because this is like the ideal segue into my next question. So as someone who has been through the licensing experience and has helped a number of small business owners apply for their own licenses, do you think the process has gotten more accessible or complicated in the past 3 years, especially for those individuals who may not have a lot of access to a lot of funding?
Well, you know, I'll say, and, you know, some things remain the same, right? I think there's always the important need for capital and for education. But I'll say in the past 3 years, we've definitely seen social equity, come around more, right? Just since the time that I was applying for a license, we've had like my guy, Tucky Blunt, out there in Oakland, opened the first social equity dispensary in Nail, whole state, nice. Right? Be, social equity. There's plenty of examples in California because they've been around longer. But now we have Illinois, they finally are awarding their licenses, and Massachusetts, great folks doing stuff out in Massachusetts that are social equity operators. And one of the things that I love is, even in the regulations now, you're seeing them be very intentional with trying to create opportunities through social equity. I know, the markets have yet to be open, but I'm super excited about what New Jersey's program is going to look like. And hopefully New York, Connecticut, Virginia, some of those places have had promising regulations too. But like I said, being from New Jersey, I'm really excited about some of the things that they put into the laws that I think will actually help to give advantage to social equity operators.
I feel that. And obviously we know it depends on the state, but for you, have you been able to identify the specific weaknesses in certain social equity licensing programs that urgently need to be addressed?
Oh, for sure. Well, again, and I can use New Jersey as the perfect example, right? Some of the things that they did well is there's no caps on licenses, right? So you don't have people competing for a finite resource. There's no capital requirement, which says, and I've had the opportunity to score applications. And in the time that I did it, you had to have a minimum amount of assets. It was like, hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? So again, if you want to be able to give access to communities that have been impacted by the war on drugs, they're likely not the same people that have hundreds of thousands of liquid capital sitting around in a bank. So like not having those capital requirements, not having a real estate requirement, not being required to have real estate. I've read stories about in Massachusetts, people that have been paying $10,000 a month for real estate, right? Waiting for years for their license approved. And if you come from a background social equity, you can't do that. So those are some of the, I think those are some of the great things that they did. And then also the cost for applications. For you can apply for a license, I think the application fee start off at like $100. So talk about, making it something that's really accessible. I think those are great examples. And I imagine that, I think those are just some of the great things that programs can do. Hopefully we'll see more of that and even more innovative ideas, that will continue to expand the access. But also, I think the fact that now a lot of places are, not excluding people that have had previous cannabis charges, more so giving them higher priority. And I think that makes sense, right? Because again, people that have been, harmed by the war on drugs that have actually been actively carrying the banner for cannabis should have an opportunity to be involved in the industry.
Absolutely. I think we agree 100% with all of that. Sure. And you just mentioned capital as a huge barrier to access. And in previous interviews, you've also identified education and preparedness on top of capital as being these barriers. So at this stage, what do you believe are the most effective or like meaningful ways to address these obstacles, either, from a business or regulatory perspective?
Sure. I think the technical assistance programs are super important. Also, that's one thing that I had the benefit of going through a program that here in Maryland, where you would get the training on not only like the business development skills, starting the LLC, all those things, but then actually business of cannabis. And that education is also super helpful. Like I know I was fortunate enough to go to Oaksterdam, Cannabis Training University, all those different places. But people being able to have access to education, like I know in California with the social equity programs, they often have access to that technical assistance. And I think that, because this is such a difficult process, right? And you think about most people have to get high-priced consultants and attorneys. If you don't have that, being able to have some type of resources to educate you on how to best walk through the process, I think, is the other most important thing that you can do. Some of that outreach comes from, you know, it can be done through regulations that those types of things are required. But then also other companies that are doing business can also contribute and help as well.
Mm-hmm. So this might be like a hard question to answer, but who do you think has more power to actually enact this change? Is it the businesses or the regulators or a combination?
Well, you know, I think it's a combination of both, right? I think it's public-private partnerships. Certainly one of the things that advocacy is important, right? So as a, you know, as a business, and this is one of the things that I'm really great and proud about with U.S. Cannabis Council and the companies we represent, right? With our advocacy and the policies that we are, that we push and fight for, even though we represent large corporations, and what I get to do, social equity, and these types of things that I talk about is at the top of the list in our considerations. So businesses have an important role to play in terms of, you know, how they do programs. Again, I mean, we've seen some great stuff, right? The parent company, you know, doing a fund for minority entrepreneurs, Curaleaf, their Rooted in Good program. They do some great things. So there's all different types of examples of how corporations can be good corporate citizens and support social equity in the cause, as well as, again, you know, having this stuff codified in the regulations and, you know, saying that this is going to be a resource and, you know, and just things are going to be what they are is very important, too, because that's the one thing I've learned. If you know, if it's not required, or, you know, if the law doesn't say it has to be done a certain type of way, it's not going to be done. And that's, you know, that again, that's the importance of policy work. And being active and, you know, contributing, like we've had opportunities like the Cannabis Administration Opportunity Act, where they were, you know, accepting comments. And so both corporations and people being able to use their voice to be a part of that political process is very important.
I love that you mentioned the parent company, because we have a wonderful client by the name of Mary Pryor, who was on the board of the parent company social equity program. So shout out to Mary on that. And also you mentioned that ancillary businesses can be lucrative opportunities for BIPOC business owners who may not necessarily have the resources to apply for a cultivation or retail license. So from your vantage point, what are the most promising ancillary opportunities out there for Black and minority business owners?
Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you one area immediately that I always think of first are our attorneys, man. Compliance and understanding the law is such low, you know, that's something that's an important part of every cannabis process, like doing up the applications. There are so many different ways that people that have legal backgrounds can get involved in the industry. I think another important one, man, there's so many, but marketing, right? Finance, man, like, you know, that was what got me in, you know, being able to do financial plans and all different parts of things like that. People that are in diversity, equity, and inclusion, right now that I've been operating in this space, there's a huge opportunity there, but accountants, man, the list goes on and on and on. Education, right? You think about different programs, people being able to put those together. Human resources, right? Because the industry is growing. And that I think that's a huge area and opportunity right there. Human resources professionals, especially because the jobs, I think Leafly's job report said there's over 321,000 jobs and it's growing, right? More states and states coming on. So HR people, anybody in the construction world, whether it's like HVAC, all those types of things, I think you should absolutely be looking at the industry. And I think those are some of the things that it's always important to highlight. I'm glad you said that, because again, if you don't have hundreds of thousands of dollars to, you know, potentially open a dispensary or cultivation, this is something you could do. You don't have to worry about 280E and you don't have to worry about all the strict regulatory structure. So I think people absolutely should pursue those types of opportunities.
Can you touch on 280E and what that is just for our listeners who are unsure?
Sure. So 280E is a part of the tax code that says because cannabis is federally illegal, business owners are not able to write off the regular business expenses that other companies have. So you end up having cannabis companies being taxed at a much higher rate So, you know, they're not really keeping a lot of the money that they have. So if that's something that applies to plant touching cannabis businesses. But if you have another type of business, like again, like a tech company or a PR company like Matteo, and you just service the industry, then you're not subject to that. So again, I think those are some of the considerations, because a lot of people think that cannabis businesses are making all this money, but if you're being taxed, you know, 60%,
sure,
on top of everything you have to do, then, you know, that's a huge impact on the business.
Definitely. Yeah. And that's something I don't think a lot of people think about or know. And it goes back to education, right? Are there any specific success stories that pop off, you know, pop up in your head in terms of Black people or, you know, minorities in general getting into the ancillary side of cannabis that you could think of?
Sure. On the ancillary side of cannabis, one good example is my brother, Otis Smith, but his company's called Tetragram. He has a company where it allows you to be able to track your cannabis use for medical patients. And I think that's a really great example of an app and the way he's found his way to create partnerships with different cannabis companies and brands. Nice. And, you know, I think that that's a good example. And like you said, Mary's another great example of a person, right? She doesn't have a plant touching business. But when we talk about somebody who's like a marketing genius and she's found her way to be involved with so many different companies, I think that's the perfect example of how people that have these skills should be looking at other industries, right? Because, you know, I think Mary was like in like tech and like, you know, those other types of spaces and that before cannabis. And I think same as me, right? Like I was in finance, and as I looked at cannabis, I saw the opportunity to use my skill set here. So I think, especially because the industry is so new and so young, there's so many different ways that people can, you know, find a way to solve a problem and what's missing in the industry and use that skill to kind of build your success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that message. Basically, you know, just use the skills you have, right? And I just feel like what you articulated is that there are so many entry points to cannabis that maybe a lot of people don't realize. You've also mentioned, you know, in previous interviews that, you know, there are a bunch of, you know, incubator programs popping up, a lot of largely due in part, you know, the industry is becoming more sophisticated and the trade organizations like the ones that you've worked for are really pushing for social equity. So based on, you know, the companies and the organizations you've worked with in the past, what would you say are like the non-negotiables for any incubator program at this point in the industry?
Sure. Well, I mean, for incubator programs, for one, that education that people offer and access to capital and resources is, you know, I think those are huge things. So programs that are doing that, again, shout out to Jay-Z's program, shout out to Eazy's program. I know Chris Webber and the Webber Wild Fund are doing some great things. So those companies that are doing business in a way where it is not exploitative, for lack of a better word, you know, these entrepreneurs that come from these communities are looking at the industry for opportunity. So again, it's great to see companies that are out here supporting them, giving them access to not only there's different things, right? Because there's shelf space, there's resources, there's education, there's capital, there's, you know, professional services like mentorship, all these different things go a long way. So there's a lot of different programs out there, Cresco Seed Program. You know, people are doing it in all different types of ways. So it's good to see, you know, those types of things happen.
Agreed. I love that. And also, you've had a very unique role in that the work you do for both the U.S. Cannabis Council and the Marijuana Policy Project, it takes on a more grassroots state level approach to policy and legalization. What types of social equity policy proposals would you say benefit the most from a grassroots advocacy push, and which initiatives have a higher chance of being passed by Congress?
Oh, well, I mean, I'll say all of them, right? I think the reason that cannabis has had success is because it's been like a movement of the people, if you will. And right now, there are a number of different bills that are out that I think are super important. One of them, of course, the Cannabis Administration Opportunity Act. I think that was a great job by Senators Booker, Schumer, and Wyden to really advance the conversation around social justice, restorative justice, and opportunities through cannabis legalization. They also went steps further to try to create a regulatory structure. And so we provided feedback from that and a number of different organizations on ways that we could all, you know, from industry input that we could add to that. And so I'm excited to see where that goes. And also the fact that they were thoughtful to take that, you know, to actually do a discussion draft and get that input, you know, from folks as part of the conversation. So I think that that's super important. Also, I'll say that the safe banking bill is super important also, right? Being able to have access to banking and capital is an important issue, and it especially affects small businesses and minority entrepreneurs. We've talked a lot about the need for funding and financing, but just the basics of having a bank account, being able to have a checking account. And believe it or not, the larger companies, they figured it out already. They have, you know, access to the private equity and things that they need. So to be able to open that up for small businesses and minority entrepreneurs and, you know, safe banking is something that should be a priority also. Of course, coming from banking, you know, I recognize that the banking system isn't perfect. But again, just being able to have access to it, I think, is something that could be hugely impactful.
I guess as a follow-up, what does like opening a checking account, banking account look like if you don't have access to this kind of like massive wealth? Like, say I am like an aspiring entrepreneur of color, I don't have this access. I can't go to Bank of America to open something up. So where do I go then?
Right. You can't go. Yeah, you definitely can't go to any of the mainstream larger banks, the Bank of America's, the PNC's, the Chase. You can't get an account there. But what people have are, you know, smaller regional banks or credit unions, or they're even specialized financial institutions like to service the cannabis industry. And the difference is that, I mean, there's thousands of dollars worth of fees, monthly fees, to be able to use these accounts. So again, you know, for one, I feel like you have to be, it takes some work to know, you know, where you can actually get access to them. Again, they're much higher cost. So when you talk about those small businesses that are trying to be in the industry, they can't, you know, they can't afford those. And those are some of the other barriers that you face. So you have people, you know, conducting business largely in cash, which makes it difficult to operate anything, whether you're paying your taxes in cash or having to buy your, you know, when I worked at a dispensary, I got my paycheck in cash. So,
crazy. Sounds so archaic.
You know, think about that and the impact that it has, that puts not only on the businesses, but also the employees. So I think that banking is something that's super important.
I can only imagine, like, if I got my paycheck in cash, I would have to hire a bodyguard.
Walk me through. I would, like, lose half of it in a day.
Right. Yes. One of the other great things about the path that I've had in the industry, like, I've really hands-on, like, experienced, you know, these things myself as part of the industry. And so, again, I take those to, as I'm thinking about the way the policies actually impact the businesses and the people. Because again, when I worked at a dispensary, it wasn't like a big chain. I worked for, like, it was like a small, you know, mom and pop, I guess you would say, that it was their only one here in Maryland. So
awesome. And where do you see the greatest disconnect between state and federal regulators when it comes to cannabis social equity and justice?
You know, I wouldn't necessarily say disconnect, but I'll say right now, every state, and I'll say, is learning from each other, right? So federal, as they're looking at federal policy, I'm sure they're looking at the state programs to try to see what's working and what's not. But right now, everything is, I mean, the industries are so new, right? The social equity, even concept of an actual full state doing it, is such a new concept. So I think it's important to get the insight from those people that are regulators to be able to learn from them, right? Like, I know the Cannabis Regulators of Color Coalition is a organization that I talk to that I think has great insight from their experiences, you know, actually doing it on the ground as we think about policy.
Absolutely. And you've also been very outspoken about building up this inclusive pipeline of talent to allow, you know, more BIPOC individuals to enter the cannabis space long term. How did you land on this idea of targeting HBCUs? And what would you want this program to look like one day when it's fully fleshed out?
Yes. So that, you know, that's been probably my biggest passion since I've come into the industry. As a Howard alum, one of the biggest things that I saw was, for one, for just the experience that I was able to get at my HBCU. For one, when I was in the School of Business, we had different corporations where we would interact with. Also, once I got out into the professional world, I was able to see how that network really supported me. When I started out at Morgan Stanley, there was another financial advisor that was a Morgan State alum that took me under his wing, and I had so many similar experiences. So I've always had the thought that, you know, as we look at diversity and the kind of the excellence that exists in HBCUs and those other types of places, that one of the biggest ways that we can kind of crack the code, if you will, is by just including people from those communities. Like I said, I've had the goal to be able to do something like this since I've come into the industry. And now that I'm at USCC, I'm actually having the opportunity to build that those types of programs. And I won't talk go into it too much, but like I said, I'm having the opportunity to like I said, to do that is something that's super cool.
I love that. Yeah, definitely keep us posted. on how this, you know, shakes out.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things that's super cool that I'm doing is important work is building relationships with professional associations or organizations outside of cannabis, because I think that we can build relationships. Again, I'm hopefully going to be speaking with the U.S. Black Chamber of Commerce and different other different types of organizations to, again, talk about the intersection and the opportunity that we have, in the future of the cannabis industry.
I guess, like, so far, have you gotten a sense of, like, hunger and excitement from students as well? Are you talking to, you know, the colleges at this point?
Oh, yeah. You know, I've had, over the past year, I've had the opportunity to speak at a number of different colleges. I got to speak virtually to some students from Spelman College last year. Before COVID ended, I was at Howard School of Business. I'm on the board of Excelsior College, like a master's certificate program. So I've had the opportunity to speak to students there a few times. So University of Maryland, they have a program, like a pharmacy program. I've had the opportunity to speak to them. So I've come across so many students that are hungry to learn about the cannabis industry. And I think one of the important things is, I think people recognizing that regardless of what their major is, whether it's government, whether they want to be in government or, finance, marketing, whatever it is, you know, there's so many opportunities here. So I think it's an important message that this is really an opportunity and industry of the future.
Love that.
And I just want to kind of pivot just a little bit and talk about New York, right? Like, everyone knew New York, you know, finally legalized marijuana this year. So obviously they drew a lot of attention, right? And passed what many would say is the most equity focused legalization bill. Of course, we've seen a lot of states in the past not live up to their promises. So do you think New York is equipped to deliver on these social equity commitments, and what kind of infrastructure will they need to create to ensure that this happens for sure?
Right. Well, I can tell you that New York has been very intentional in their process. Even the fact that they passed the bill, you know, it was important to them that social equity was going to be a part of it. And also the hires and the people that they put in place to run New York's program, show their commitment to that. So, you know, I think, again, it's going to be about building that infrastructure. And then also, I think, looking to the examples from other places of what's been done. But I definitely have a lot of confidence in New York. I'll tell you, even just what I've seen so far, like from New York's cannabis community, has been super exciting. I had the opportunity to go up last month to an art event hosted by Happy Monkey that was like the Van Gogh exhibit, and it was amazing just seeing that.
I heard about that one.
Like the New York like art and cannabis culture collide. And, you know, like being able, like, you know, you go into an art exhibit and you get a pre-roll in the beginning, like just thinking that was real. And even the fact that I'll say New York historically, right, the history that they've had with Stop and Frisk and like the way that they've, you know, really pursue minority communities through cannabis, and to now see it where you can consume cannabis like anywhere where you can smoke a cigarette in New York. So, like, again, to see the shift of where it's come from that to this is amazing.
And speaking of the people in charge of this program, so in September, our new governor, Kathy Hochul, appointed Chris Alexander and Tremaine Wright to lead New York's Office of Cannabis Management. So based on the policy failures and successes you've seen in other states, what would you say are the most important parts of the MRTA that they need to prioritize during this whole implementation process?
Well, you know, a lot of what they're allowed to do with the rules is what's spelled out in the bill that was passed. And so what they're going to have to do is, you know, take that as well as the priorities that they've identified to build a program. You know, New York's bill, I'll say I don't know inside out. But again, I think that, you know, again, with the guidance that they have from that, as well as the leadership and what their goals are, I think I'm confident that they would do a, you know, that they would do a good job up there.
I'm keeping my fingers and my toes crossed.
There's different industry groups that can be resources to be able to assist with those types of things that have had, you know, that have had that experience in other states. You know, that's a big part of what MPP does. The organizations like DPA, Normal, Minority Cannabis Business Association, all do similar things. So I think being able to get those input, like, you know, that input from, you know, people that can help that have done it in other places can also be helpful too.
And for you, what parts of the industry are giving you the most hope and anxiety over the next year?
That's interesting. You know, hopefully I think we'll see some more development of, you know, licensing opportunities. I think that's always important for me, right? The ancillary stuff is great, but to the point that you made, now that we have a few different states that have passed their laws, actually delivering on those promises is going to be super important. I think Illinois has been a lesson in that. So, you know, fingers crossed, as somebody being from New Jersey, I'll say that that's close and near and dear to my heart. So I'm, you know, watching that closely. But again, all of these other states. And then just the fact that I feel like we're so close on the horizon to federal legalization is something that's super, it's just super exciting to see that all the different bills advancing at the level that they have, and getting to have a front row seat to some of these conversations has been something that I've enjoyed. I literally like love being a part of this and getting to do this type of stuff every day.
Yeah. I guess speaking of federal legalization, are you concerned about the lack of or like whatever safeguards are in place to protect, you know, smaller businesses or minority owned businesses, you know, when the floodgates open? Like, are you concerned like that a big player is just going to come in and dominate everything? Or, you know, what are your thoughts on how that's going to progress?
For sure. Well, I think some of the keys to that are going to be making sure that the regulations in place aren't too burdensome, like for small businesses and minority entrepreneurs to be able to put up with. And that's going to have to do with what type of, you know, regulatory structures they set up. Again, I think making sure that access to capital and resources is addressed, you know, especially if it's going to be at the federal level. And then when you talk about minority and small businesses being able to compete, I think the idea of how, you know, how interstate commerce is regulated and how that plays out is also going to play an important role in it. So, again, I think that these are all things that are going to take, you know, thoughtful conversation to make sure we get it right. Because to your point, once we're out of the bag, it's, you know, it's done. So we want to make sure that that the systems that are in place are beneficial so that minority businesses and small, you know, small businesses, women-owned businesses can compete in the market.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And sure. I think we are all confident that you and the rest, you know, USCC, MPP are going to make sure that this is going to be rolled out in a mm-hmm. good way. Right. Right. So with that being said, and all the amazing insight that you've given us this episode, we're going to dive into the fun part of our show.
Favorite.
I got 5 on it. So we just ask you like very casual questions about what you like about cannabis, what you like to do with it, all that good stuff. So
rapid fire,
indica or sativa?
Indica.
Nice.
Indica, because you'd be in the bed. Yes.
All day.
Flower, edible, or concentrate?
Oh, flower, man, all day.
It's a crap favorite.
Like a, gotta have
the real thing, man.
What's on your rotation these days?
My rotation these days, I've had some Wedding Punch, some Purple Kush. Those Classic. Are the strains I got right now.
Nice. Yum. That sounds fun.
If you had to choose one slang term for cannabis for the rest of your life, which one would it be?
Weed.
Nice.
Oldie but a goodie, right?
You can't yeah. Classic, yeah.
yeah. You can't get better than, you can't, doesn't get better than that.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you could smoke with any celebrity, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
Man, you know what? I think right now I would say Jay-Z, just because I know there's been a conversation about, you know, on that I've seen on the internet about would you take $500,000?
Yeah.
Right. That's I'll been everywhere.
That and just say, I want to smoke a J with Jay-Z, man. Like, some of their stuff, man. Let's do that.
That actually sounds like a podcast name, Smoke yeah. a J with Jay-Z.
Jay with Jay-Z, yeah. man. Hey, I don't know if he's plugging the network, but maybe he's listening, man. Jay, what's up? Let's smoke one.
yeah.
It's people who reach out to your people.
Absolutely. Well, on High Priority, we definitely believe in the power of manifestation. So
yes.
this is going to happen for you just because you put it out there.
Hey, I've been manifesting for these past like couple years and it's just been happening. So I'll add that to it.
Yes.
You've got a great track record so far. So last question, if you had your own special brand of weed, what would you name it and why?
I would name it Trenton Made because where I came from in Trenton, New Jersey, there was this big saying called Trenton makes, the world takes. It's like on the side of our bridge there. Trenton used to be a big like industrial town that was known for, you know, really supplying a lot of different things across the country. But since it's become economically depressed. So if I had a cannabis brand, it would be something that represented, you know, represented that and bringing that back to, you know, bringing that legacy back.
Oh, I love that.
Love that. He's proud of where he's from, ladies and gentlemen. That's hey, awesome.
Always gotta represent. Trey makes the world takes for sure.
Hey, I love it. Now the last question. So I know people are going to want to contact you. They're going to want to slide in your DMs. They're going to have a lot of questions after this interview. So for our listeners who want to find you, how can they go about doing that?
Of course. Tahir Johnson, you can find me by my name on LinkedIn and Facebook. And then Ty Diddy everywhere else on Instagram and Twitter. And then also my email, you can just email me at Tahir at thecannabisdiversityreport.com. I'll respond to that one. I'll give that one out so everybody doesn't flood my work emails. And then also, like I said, every week I have a podcast called The Cannabis Diversity Report. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a good place to kind of keep up with some of the conversations I'm having with people in the industry, too.
Amazing.
That's it. Love it. Thanks for coming on High Priority. This has been definitely one of those bucket list interviews for me and Chelsea. Mm-hmm. So we are just ecstatic that you were able to carve out a little time for a little old us.
Nah, yes. Thank you so much for having me. Can't wait to hear it. And anytime.
Thanks again for listening to High Priority. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Special thanks to Antoine Dry, Donald Edwards, and Jim Pryor from Dirty Soap Entertainment for our intro music. To learn more about our show and parent company, Matteo Communications, head on over to our website at matteo.com. That's M-A-T-T-I-O.com.